Fitzsimmons decided he had nothing to lose. Howard amused himself by putting a $100 bet on the horse, then settled in to watch. Smith was terrified. He had studied Seabiscuit's past performances and knew that the horse did not run his best in mud. The trainer stood on the track apron and fretted. Seabiscuit broke slowly and dropped farther and farther back. By mid-race, he was trailing by at least 10 lengths. Smith was dismayed, but Seabiscuit began to rally. Slogging through the slop, he lumbered up to his competitor, pushing as hard as he could, and passed him. It wasn't much of a race, but it was a win nonetheless. The official daily racing form record of this race states that Seabiscuit held the lead from the start, but it appears to be an error. Multiple eyewitness accounts of this race state that Seabiscuit trailed badly early, then rallied to win. Howard was satisfied. The horse had grit. "I can't describe the feeling he gave me," Howard said later. "But somehow I knew he had what it takes. Tom and I realized that we had our worries and troubles ahead. We had to rebuild him, both mentally and physically. But you don't have to rebuild the heart when it's already there, big as all outdoors." Smith breathed a sigh of relief. Years later, he would shiver at the thought of how easily he could have lost the colt in the driving rain that day. Howard let Mills know that the offer was still on the table. Mills mulled it over. Fitzsimmons had become deeply fond of the colt and entertained private doubts about parting with him. "Seabiscuit might," he muttered dubiously, "win another purse." He didn't share his reservations with Mills, an omission he would come to regret. Howard found Mills in the Saratoga paddock. "Deal or no deal?" he asked.
"Deal," said Mills.
Howard wrote out a check to Mills, then gave his new horse to Marcella. Tom Smith had found the horse who would lift him from obscurity. On an August day in 1936, Seabiscuit was led from the Fitzsimmons barn for the last time. No one came to see him go. Fitzsimmons hadn't been told that the sale had gone through, so he didn't come to say his goodbyes. Seabiscuit was walked down the back stretch, a long canopy of trees bowing over his head. At the Howard barn, Smith waited, flanked by a cluster of stable hands. Though the trainer hardly ever said anything, there was an air to him that day that told the grooms how special the horse was to him. One kid who had not picked up on it was a teenaged apprentice jockey named Farrell Jones, who joined the others at the barn as Seabiscuit was led up. Seeing a thin, homely animal, Jones made the understandable assumption that this was no racehorse.
"Looks like they got a new saddle horse," he blurted out, loud enough for Smith to hear.
The grooms shushed him. A few days later, Smith led Seabiscuit up onto a rail car, and the Howard barn pushed off for the Detroit fairgrounds. Smith began thinking about finding a jockey. Chapter 4 The Cougar and the Iceman. Red Pollard was sinking downward through his life with the pendulous motion of a leaf falling through still air. In the summer of 1936, he was 26 and in the 12th year of a failing career as a jockey and part-time prize fighter. He was an elegant young man, tautly muscled, with a shock of supernaturally orange hair. Whenever he got near a mirror, he wetted down a comb and slicked the hair back like Tyrone Power, but it had a way of rearing up on him again. His face had a downward sliding quality, as if his features were just beginning to melt. He was, statistically speaking, one of the worst riders anywhere. Lately, at least. Once, he had been one of the best, but those years were far behind him. He had no money and no home. He lived entirely on the road of the racing circuit, sleeping in empty stalls, carrying with him only a saddle, his rosary, and his books. Pocket volumes of Shakespeare, Omar Khayyam's Rubaiyat, a little copy of Robert Service's Songs of the Sourdough, maybe some Emerson, whom he called Old Waldo.
The books were the closest thing he had to furniture, and he lived in them the way other men live in easy chairs. On the day Seabiscuit settled in at the Detroit fairgrounds, Pollard was in North Randall, Ohio, sweltering through August at a middling racetrack called Thistledown Park, which was wrapping up its summer meeting. Pollard's career had continued slipping there, as it had everywhere else. His win percentage had dropped into the single digits. The last horse he rode came to a halt right in the middle of his race. On August 16, 1936, when Thistledown Park shuttered its doors for the season, Red Pollard appeared to be out of chances. Back home in Edmonton, Alberta, he had been known as Johnny. Right from his boyhood, people had seen the restlessness in him. They must have known he wouldn't stay in their town for long. Wanderlust ran in his family. Johnny's father and namesake, the son of an Irish emigre who had become a Union cavalryman, had spent his young adulthood rambling across the western Canadian wilderness in search of gold. In 1898, prospecting led him to a nearly vacant trail crossing that the trappers called Edmonton, where he found that the soil was the perfect medium for making brick. The Irishman staked a claim, opened a brick factory on the banks of the North Saskatchewan River, and made a fortune on the Northwest's turn-of-the-century construction boom. He bought up a huge portion of Edmonton and built the first real house in town, a vast home surrounded by sprawling acres of virgin countryside. With his wife Edith, he raised seven whip-smart, buoyant children, Jim, Johnny, Bill, Edie, Betty, Nora, and a little girl whom, with characteristic Pollard whimsy, they called Bubbles. The elder Pollard's brother Frank and his family moved in to join the business, and the Pollard home was soon teeming with 16 family members and a host of workers who took their meals at the house. Born in November 1909, Johnny was the liveliest member of a clever and boisterous family. In the Pollard home, books were always open, old Irish songs sung, jigs danced, long stories spun. Johnny played on the grassy fields of his family's estate and spent his Sundays in the lap of the family Model T, competing with his siblings for a window seat. As the car swung over a high bridge that crossed the North Saskatchewan River, he could peer over the railing to see the family business at the water's edge below. Misfortune struck suddenly and forcefully. In 1915, the river boiled up in a flash flood, ripping over the shoreline around the factory. Johnny's father rescued his family from the water by throwing them in a buggy and lugging them up the bank himself. But he couldn't save the factory machinery. The business vanished, and the tax bill arrived. Pollard traveled around Canada, trying in vain to find a bank to lend him the money. The city of Edmonton foreclosed, and the Pollards lost everything but their house. Virtually overnight, Johnny's father was bankrupt with seven children and a wife to feed. He eventually found meager income as an auto repairman. It was only by bartering gasoline for groceries that he managed to keep his family alive. Johnny found myriad avenues of distraction from his family's penury. One was athletic. His father took him and his brother Bill to the community boxing ring, where they were swept up in the prize-fighting craze of the 1920s. Bill, a tall, powerful fighter, made it to the Golden Gloves. Johnny, smaller and leaner, became a proficient and scrappy fighter but never achieved his brother's success. He amused himself by provoking much bigger boys into fights, calling his Golden Glove brother to the rescue and laughing as they ran in terror. His other escape was intellectual. Johnny devoured great literature. He committed long passages of prose and poetry to memory and engaged in lively recitation duels with his sister Edie as they bounced over the local roads in the Model T. Graced with an agile mind, he had the makings of a man of letters. Later, when his fate became known, his boyhood friends would wish for his sake that he had gone the way of the academy. But the classroom smothered him. He desperately wanted to explore the wider world. He was impatient with his lessons, mouthed off at teachers, got poor grades, spent his hours coining witticisms and engineering elaborate practical jokes. His emotions were liquid. His anger was a wild rage. His pleasure, jubilation. his humor biting, his sorrow and empathy a bottomless abyss. He was, his son John would later remember, a person who brought an uproar with him wherever he went. Johnny Pollard was a caged bird. As he grew, his restlessness turned into aspiration. His father had somehow managed to obtain a gift for his second son, a little horse named Forest Dawn. To help make ends meet, Johnny began hitching the horse to his toboggan and using them to make deliveries for the local grocery. In long afternoons aboard the pony's back, Johnny discovered a gift for riding. His daughter, writer Nora Christensen, remembers that he had the body of a dancer, lithe and wiry and thin, everything in balance, a physique ideally suited to the pitch and yaw of a horse's withers. Riding also suited his passion for risk. His life, from his youth onward, was a headlong rush into danger and uncertainty. Out on Edmonton's dirt roads, his legs swinging free from Forest Dawn's sides while the toboggan bobbed along behind, Johnny decided he wanted to be a jockey. As he entered his teens, Johnny began haunting local stables, trading his labor for a chance to ride. He appealed to his parents to let him go out on the racing circuit and learn to be a jockey. His mother wanted to stop him. His father did not. Perhaps the aging prospector understood the futility of trying to contain a torrential boy within the confines of a small town. Perhaps he was proud of Johnny's aspirations to make a career of sport. Surely money played a role in the decision Pollard would make. He was barely able to feed his children. But his wife was frightened. In 1925, the Pollards made a compromise. Johnny would be allowed to go to the racetrack to pursue his career, but only on the condition that he be escorted by a trusted family friend. The Pollards swallowed their fears, kissed their son goodbye, and handed him over to his new guardian. Sometime in 1925, Johnny and his guardian pulled into the old mining town of Butte, Montana, where the local Bull Ring racetrack linked up with a network of other tracks, carnivals, and fairs. Featuring bottom-level thoroughbreds and quarter horses, these tracks offered the worst of low-rent racing. Most were little more than makeshift ovals cut through hayfields. Races were begun either by walking horses away from the starter, then spinning them around when the starter said go, a method called lap and tap, or by lining them up behind a simple webbing that was rigged to spring upward to start the race, sometimes catching riders under the chin. Purses were often smaller than the cost of shoeing a horse, about $1.40. The tracks were only a half mile round. The turns were so tight that a horse with a head of steam on him, elite quarter horses, had been clocked at peak speeds of well over 50 miles per hour, would go winging off into the hay if he didn't ease back as he left the straightaway. It was nothing special, but it was a start. Johnny had only just arrived when his guardian vanished. The man never returned. Pollard was completely alone and penniless in a remote town of a foreign country. He was just 15 years old, and his boyhood was over. If Pollard had any way to get home, he didn't use it. Somehow, he managed to find a place to sleep and something to eat. He began wandering around the carnivals and tracks, trying to talk his way onto the backs of horses. Though he towered over other jockeys, ultimately leveling off at about 5'7", he hadn't filled out his frame yet, weighing just 101 pounds, light enough to ride. The local racetrackers grew fond of the odd, bookish boy, nicknaming him Red, and a few let him ride their horses. It was a rough place to start a career. Racing in the bush leagues was utterly lawless. "If you could survive there," remembered former jockey Joe Mossy Mossbacher, "you could ride anywhere." With no race cameras and only two patrol judges to oversee them, jockeys could, and would, do anything to win. Jockeys on trailing horses grabbed hold of leading horses' tails or saddle cloths so their own horses could be towed around the track, saving energy. They joined arms with other jockeys to clothesline riders trying to cut between horses, formed obstructive flying wedges to block closers, and bashed passing horses into the inside rail. They hooked their legs over other jockeys' knees, ensuring that if their rivals moved forward, they'd be scraped off their saddles. They dangled their feet in front of passing horses to intimidate them. And when less inspired, they shoved and punched one another and grabbed one another's reins. Because many of the tracks had no inner rail, some jockeys simply cut through the infield, dodging haystacks to win. In some cases, riders toppled their opponents right off their horses. Such tactics were, until the mid-1930s, seen at all levels of racing. But nowhere were they used with such ruthlessness as on the bush tracks where Pollard got his start. According to the great jockey, Eddie Arcaro, who once rammed another rider over the rail in retribution for a bump, "I was trying to kill that Cuban SOB," he told the stewards, who reformed him with a year's suspension. The desire to win wasn't the only motivation. The Bush Leagues contained two kinds of riders, kids like Pollard, seeking to make their names, and veterans, in the bitter waning days of their careers, sliding down to this last and lowest place in the sport. "To succeed in those days, you had to fight for everything you got," Arcaro wrote in his autobiography, "I Ride to Win." "You were competing with men who were aware that their own particular sons were fading, and they resented your moving into the places they would leave. They fought you, and you fought them back." Pollard took a few licks, held his own, and learned a lot. But months passed, and he still didn't win a single race. In danger of starving, he used the only other skill he had, straying into carnival bull rings and cowtown clubs to moonlight as a prize fighter. He was no headliner. Mostly he boxed in preliminary matches to warm up the crowd. At the time, a local kid nicknamed the Nebraska Wildcat was the hottest boxing property around. In imitation, Pollard took the ring name Cougar. His skills didn't live up to the nickname. "He fought a lot of matches and lost," he said. "A lot of them." Though a misnomer, his nickname proved to be the one enduring thing about Pollard's ring career. Racetrackers in that era had a peculiar animosity for given names. Among those haunting the track in Pollard's day were Lying Tex, Truthful Tex, Scratchy Balls John, Cow Shit Red, Piss Through the Screen Slim, and a man the trackers called Booger. Baptist John was the nickname of a tracker famed for being run over by a police car that was chasing him, breaking his leg. He left the cast on his leg until it rotted off, so that in the words of horseman Wad Studley, "one leg went north and the other one southwest." The given names of half the people at the track were complete mysteries. The name Cougar followed Pollard from the boxing ring to the races and stuck with him for good. He liked the name, referred to himself by it, preferred that his closest friends use it, and gave it to every dog he ever owned. A year passed. Pollard didn't win a race. The break he needed came from a genial old former jockey named Asa C. Acey Smith, a traveling gyp or gypsy trainer. Passing through Montana, Acey thought he saw promise in Pollard, signed him on as his rider, and brought him on a road trip to western Canada. It was at a little fair track that Pollard finally rode a winner, H.C. Bash, in a mile-and-a-half race in the fall of 1926. It was a momentous event. Once a rider logged his first win, he officially became an apprentice jockey, or bug boy, so-called because of the asterisk, or bug, that was typed next to apprentices' names in the racing program. Then, as now, all racehorses were assigned a weight, called an impost, to carry in each race. The impost consisted of the jockey, his roughly 4.5 pounds of saddle, boots, pants, and silks, and, if necessary, lead pads inserted into the saddle. To help aspiring riders establish themselves in the sport, a horse ridden by a bug boy had his impost reduced by 5 pounds. The bug offered a substantial break. The rule of thumb is that every 2 to 3 pounds slows a horse by a length in racing's middle distances of 1 mile to 1.25 miles, while in longer races, every pound slows a horse by 1 length. Bug boys enjoyed the weight break until they rode their 40th winner or reached the anniversary of their first win, whichever came first. After that, they were journeyman riders. In that era, virtually all jockeys were signed to stable contracts, which were clear and simple. in exchange for housing, usually a cot and a vacant horse stall, and about $5 a week for food, Bug Boys gave the trainer first call on their riding services, their toil in an unending stream of barn chores and authoritarian control over their lives. Journeymen earned a slightly higher salary and usually escaped the chores. If a stable had no horses in a race, its contract jockeys were allowed to freelance for other barns. When riding for their contract stables, Bug Boys received nothing from the purses their horses won. Journeymen and freelancing Bug Boys earned $15 for a winner, $5 for every other placing, minus fees for laundry, 50 cents, valet, $1, and agent, 10%, if they could afford one. Technically, freelancing jockeys were due a 10% cut of purses, usually about $40 at the better tracks where Pollard rode, and 50 cents for galloping horses and morning workouts, but almost no one paid it. The best journeymen negotiated for higher pay, and some tried to even things out for the struggling ones, offering to save or divide the winning purse among all the riders. But this was eventually made illegal, as it removed the incentive for winning. In this system, a tiny subset of riders became wealthy, a few lived comfortably, and the rest, the vast majority, had nothing. The world of Bug Boy jockeys was populated mostly by teenagers who had run away or been orphaned, or whose families had come upon hard times, as Pollard said. "Every one of them would have a story," recalls Mosbacher, who wound up at the track after running away from an impoverished home. Only a few had an elementary school education, and none had made it through high school. Most had no place else to go. "I was hungry," explained child Bug Boy Ralph Nevis, who came to the races as an orphaned runaway, "and too nervous to steal." By the rules, a boy had to be at least 16 to ride, but no one ever asked for a birth certificate. Some riders started as young as 12. During one 1920s season at the old Tijuana track, former rider Bill Buck remembered, the two oldest riders were just 16. Bug Boys were often remarkably small. Wad Studley was so tiny when he started riding, 82 pounds, that he had trouble lifting his own saddle. On the day he rode his first winner, Tommy Luther weighed 79 pounds. Most of these boys knew nothing of racing when they began and were completely at the mercy of their trainers. Some trainers became surrogate parents to their Bug Boys. Others exploited their charges with relentless cruelty. Luther recalled that in some stables, a Bug Boy's punishment for losing a race was a stout beating. Father Bill Daly, a peg-legged trainer described by one rider as villainous, reportedly carried a barrel stave with him at all times so he could beat his jockeys. When they weighed too much, he reportedly cleaned their pockets of their pennies so they couldn't buy food or lock them up until they starved down to the right weight. To avoid train fare, Luther and his fellow Bug Boys were stowed away in horse cars. When the railroad police came through the train, impaling the haystacks to flush out stowaways, the trainers packed the boys into tack trunks. On another occasion, a trainer put Luther up in a hotel, then booted him out the window when the bill came due. On the track, Bug Boys were like any other commodity, to be leased, sold, swapped for horses, put up as collateral, and staked in card games. Though they earned practically nothing, they could be worth a lot, upwards of $15,000 for a good one. Many Bug Boys were sold without their knowledge. In 1928, jockey Johnny Longdon learned of his change of ownership early one morning in Winnipeg, where his trainer had put him up in a tent. While he slept, a stranger walked up and began shaking the tent violently. "Get the hell out of here," barked a voice from outside. "You're working for me now, and nobody on my payroll sleeps late." Pollard was lucky. AC treated him well. In the summer, he usually raced at the cluster of tracks around Vancouver or at another Western Canadian track called Glacier Park. In the fall and spring, it was California's Tanforan. In the winter, Tijuana. Pollard spent his days aboard AC's animals and his nights in a stall sandwiched between two horses, subsisting on his books and irregular meals from the track kitchen. Veteran horsemen were merciless to kids who wanted to be jockeys. A common prank was to send a new bug boy all over the track looking for the phantom key to the quarter pole. One kid who came to the track in Tijuana and announced he wanted to be a jockey was told he had to take off some weight. Horsemen draped him in 2 horse blankets and made him run around the track in 110-degree heat. They watched him make 1 trip down the track, reconsider his ambition, and keep right on going into town. They never saw him or their blankets again. Pollard got much the same treatment, but he was almost impossible to discourage. "Who hit you in the butt with a saddle and told you you could ride?" a starter hissed before a race. "The same SOB that hit you in the butt and told you you could start," he shot back. Pollard had found the one place on earth that could hold his interest. He was broke, hungry, and according to his sister Edie, happy as heck. He never lived in Edmonton again. His mother worried over his fate, but hid it from her children. His father, eager to see him and furious with the man who had abandoned him, scraped together a few dollars and traveled all the way to Vancouver to stand in the crowd and watch his son ride. Thanks to the rigid rules governing bug boys, Pollard was not even allowed to turn his head to look at his father as he rode past. Never again would anyone in his family have the money to come see him. Pollard struggled to find his place. In 1926, he had only 8 mounts, winning with just 1 of them. But under AC's tutelage, he began to find his niche. In his first season in Tijuana, he befriended a blind trainer named Jerry Duran, who was struggling to make something of a horse named Preservator. Devoid of talent, in 3 years and 46 starts, he had won just 5 races. Preservator was also a comparatively geriatric 7 years old, roughly the equivalent of a human runner in his late 30s, competing against 20-somethings. Duran brought Pollard on board as Preservator's jockey. Seeing that Duran was incapable of handling many of the training duties, the 17-year-old took them on himself. In Pollard's care, Preservator improved dramatically, winning 6 races and earning a respectable $3,170. After each race, Pollard would read the official chart for Preservator's performance out loud to Duran. When the horse ran poorly, Pollard skipped over the disappointing race notes and invented tales of Preservator's impressive feats, dreaming of bad luck excuses to account for the horse's losses. His efforts heartened Duran and impressed other horsemen who began to hire him. In 1927, he was assigned to ride more horses, and once in a while, he won. His small measure of success didn't go unnoticed. After seeing Pollard booting AC's horses around Glacier Park, a horseman named Freddie Johnson contacted AC and asked how much he wanted for the jockey. After a brief negotiation, a deal was struck. Pollard came cheap. For 2 saddles, a handful of bridles, and 2 sacks of oats, he became, for all intents and purposes, the property of Freddie Johnson. Johnson handed him over to his trainer, Russ McGurr. McGurr soon discovered that Pollard had a rare skill. His natural empathy and experience with the horses of the bullring circuit had given him insight into the minds of ailing, nervous horses. He rode horses no one else was willing to go near. He had learned to keep his whip idle, compensating by riding with somewhat longer stirrups that allowed him to urge horses gently with his lower legs. The horses responded to his kind handling, relaxed under him, and tried their hardest. Under McGurr, Pollard became known as a specialist in rogues and troubled horses and began to win regularly with them. Because a large percentage of his mounts were claimers competing for tiny purses, Pollard didn't earn much money. He mailed most of what little he did make to his father to help him hang on to the family house. The rest usually went out in loans to needy friends. Pollard was a pushover, and all the down-and-outers knew exactly where to go to pick up a few bucks. He never had the heart to ask for it back. "I never could," he would later say in his odd way. "Throw money around like glue." But he was getting a lot of mounts and winning with almost 10% of them, so he got by. After 2 years in the saddle, it seemed that Pollard was going to make it. On the backstretch at Lansdowne Park in the cool Vancouver summer of 1927, Red Pollard first saw George Monroe Wolfe. He must have been quite a sight. Everything about Wolfe spoke in the imperative. The first thing everyone noticed was the spectacular cowboy garb. 10-gallon spanking white cowboy hats, blocked pork pie style, weighty signet rings, smoked eyeglasses, fringed leather jackets, ornate breeches, gabardine shirts tailored to his powerful shoulders and dyed in a confusion of color, and hand-tooled cowboy boots embossed with animal images in real silver. Arrestingly handsome, George had dark blonde hair that cruised back from a part he kept just a nudge off-center, as was the fashion. He held his chin up, Mussolini style, and the corners of his mouth turned up in a smothered smile as if he knew something no one else did. He spoke in a slow, drizzling drawl, but his eyes were as clear and sharp as a cat's. He decorated in frontier art, pored over Western magazines, listened to Gene Autry on the phonograph, and motored around town in a blindingly ostentatious hot rod Studebaker Roadster with a Bug Boy riding shotgun. Wolf, remembered former Bug Boy Sonny Greenberg, was fabulous in everything he'd done. In the summer of 27, he was 17, aloof, clever, and utterly singular. He also may have been the greatest riding talent racing ever saw. Wolf had the ideal pedigree for a jockey. His mother, Rose, was a mounted circus acrobat. His father, Henry, was a stagecoach driver and rancher who, George liked to say, never had much money but always owned a fast horse and a fightin' bulldog. His brothers were both professional horsebreakers. Accordingly, expectations for Wolf's career in the saddle preceded him into the world. On May 31st, 1910, in the wheat and cattle country of Cardston, Alberta, Rose was midway through her labor with George when her husband interrupted the doctor. How long, he asked, before he could put the child up on a horse? If the doctor counseled patience, his words didn't leave an impression. While growing up in Cardston, and later on the similarly broad scapes of Babb, Montana, Wolf couldn't remember a time when his view of the world wasn't framed by a set of horse's ears. Must have been born on one, he mused. Riding, he said without exaggeration, is as natural as walking to me. He spent more of his youth on horseback than on foot. Horses are in my blood, he said. I'll be with them until I die. Setting aside an ambition to be a Canadian Mountie, Wolfe began race riding while in his mid-teens, apparently padding his age by a year. He cut his teeth on Montana match races, relays on unpedigreed horses in Indian country, and contests at rough tracks with names like Chinook and Stampede. Freddie Johnson and Russ McGurr were quick to snatch up Wolf's contract and watched as their purchase became a smashing overnight success in the minor leagues. In 1927, Wolf was spotted by Louis Theodore Whitey Whitehill, a top horseman, who soon called a meeting with Johnson. Whitey had a good claimer named Pickpocket that caught Johnson's eye. Whitey was equally enamored of Wolf's riding. An even swap of horse for boy was made. Whitey brought Wolf to Vancouver, then down to Tijuana, and turned him loose. No one had ever seen anything like George Wolf. Right out of the box, he won every prize that wasn't nailed down. He was something to watch, poring over his horse's back, belly flat to the withers, fingers threaded through the reins, face pressed into the mane, body curving along the ebb and flow of the animal's body. He could learn a horse's mind from the bob of the head, the tension in the reins, the coil of the hindquarters. Fifths of a second ticked off with precision in his head. Wolf timed his horse's rallies so precisely that he regularly won races with heart-stopping last-second dives. He could, racetrackers marveled, hold an elephant an inch away from a peanut until time to feed. He had an uncanny prescience, as if he lived 20 seconds ahead of himself, seeing the coming trap along the rail or the route to the outside. His commands had the understatement of the ancient cavalry art of dressage. He was shrewd, and he was fearless, demonstrating such cold unflappability in the saddle that race caller Joe Hernandez gave him the nickname Iceman. It stuck. Wolf's phenomenal success came partly from God-given gifts, partly from experience, and partly from exhaustive study. He prowled the heads of his mounts and everyone else's, scouring the daily racing form for every tidbit of information that could give him an edge, and cracked contests wide open by ruthlessly exploiting his rivals' weaknesses. His memory was a catalog of vital notes on horses and men, hangs in the stretch, balks in close quarters, only hits right-handed. He also developed a race preparation technique that was a half-century ahead of its time. Sitting in the jockey's room before a race, he would close his eyes and visualize how the race would be run. He would see the pitfalls and opportunities develop and run the race in his head until he saw how to win it. "He didn't ride his races," said his arch-rival Eddie Arcaro. "He crafted them." Like all athletic greats, Wolf was a driving perfectionist. He abruptly sold his tack and announced his retirement in disgust over a ride he thought was poor. After being briefly suspended for making a mistake in a race at Tijuana in 1930, he stomped up to the jockey's room, cleaned out his locker, lugged everything outside, heaped it into a big pile, and set the whole mass on fire. "Me? Ride again?" he said. "No siree." He then jumped into his convertible, sped all the way to Canada, stopped at the first Mountie station he found, and tried to enlist. Rejected for his diminutive stature, he sequestered himself in the Canadian wilderness, a hunting and a fishing. Months later, he reappeared in the jockey's room and went back to riding the hide off of every jockey in town. As Wolf matured and honed his craft, his moments of self-loathing gave way to quiet, unwavering confidence. He was greatness fully realized, and he knew it. Where other elite athletes betray their doubts about their capacities with displays of touchy egotism, Wolf was utterly insouciant. He could not be rattled. "George," remembered racing official Chick Lang, "was a guy that you could put on a street corner and two cars would have a head-on collision right in front of him, and he would say, 'Gee, look at that,' while everybody else would be running in all directions." He seemed devoid of fear. On the track, while other riders flailed and winced and scratched their way around, the Iceman sat chilly, as loose as water, his legs and hands supple and still. Photographers shooting races would record jockeys in various attitudes of strain. In the middle of it all would be Wolf, smiling the way a man does when he humors a child. While other riders dragged themselves to the barn to gallop horses at 4 a.m., 7 days a week, compelled by abiding fear that their skills would wane or trainers would forget them, Wolf slept in, rarely showing up at the track before noon. "He was a better rider than most of us, and he knew it," remembered fellow jockey Mossbacher. "So he just kind of took the easier way." Wolf was an uncensored man in word and deed. "As a jockey," wrote Red Pollard's friend David Alexander, a columnist for the Morning Telegraph, "Wolf is noted for doing exactly the right thing at exactly the right time. He is also noted for saying what some persons consider the wrong thing at the wrong time. When asked a direct question, he could be counted on to say something so bald and undeniable that he would leave everyone around him gaping. After losing one major race on a highly regarded runner, he flatly told the national press, surely to the horror of the owner, that the horse just wasn't any good. On the night after Wolf won a top-stakes race, the owner of the winning horse called to invite him to a post-race soiree with the moneyed set. "You tell him," Wolf replied, kicking back with a big steak, a long, cool beer, and a group of his roughneck friends, "that if the horse had got beat, they wouldn't invite us over. We got a party of our own." Wolf, remembered his close friend Bill Buck, done what Wolf wanted to do. Throughout his career, if he felt like taking a day off, he'd just pack up and go, leaving his exasperated agent and jilted trainers hunting for him. On one occasion, after he failed to appear for several potentially lucrative races, his agent found him starring in a bull riding exhibition. He once vanished without a trace a few days before the Preakness Stakes, throwing the entire Maryland racing community, including an owner who wanted him to ride one of the race favorites, into an uproar. He glided back to civilization 3 days later, tanned and happy. While driving through Pennsylvania, he had simply happened upon a beautiful lake, pulled over, and taken an impromptu fishing vacation in perfect serenity. When he disappeared on another afternoon, horsemen eventually found him in a crowd watching a visiting Montana rodeo. A trick rider had claimed that he could jump a car while riding two horses simultaneously, Roman style, a foot in one stirrup of each. Wolf called his bluff and volunteered his gleaming new Cord Roadster for the job. The horses nicked the car up pretty good, but made it over. Wolf felt the spectacle was worth the price of new paint and a furious agent. Only his contract trainer, Whitey, was unfazed by his jockey's behavior. This needled Wolf. To raise Whitey's blood pressure a bit, Wolf started delaying his horse's rallies until the last possible second. He would send a friend to sit nearby and watch the color drain from Whitey's face as Wolf waited and waited and waited before driving for the lead just when it seemed too late. Whitey surely whitened a little more with every closing kick, but the Iceman knew what he was doing. Incredibly, Wolf's timing was so good that he rode for more than a decade before he was beaten in a photo finish of a stakes race. Wolf was fanatical about clean riding. He never initiated any rough riding tactics and took justice into his own hands when anyone fouled him. He was known to haul off and crack offending riders right in the mouth with his whip. Then, frankly tell the stewards exactly what he'd done when a lie could have gotten him out of trouble. He rode claiming races with as much zeal as he rode the Santa Anita Handicap. He was also not above a little playful heckling. A few choice words from the Iceman could spook his rivals into blowing their game plans. George Wolf, from the very beginning, stood a rung above Red Pollard. While Pollard bedded down in a horse stall at night and grazed out of the track kitchen, Wolf lived in the comfort of Whitey's house, eating home-cooked meals. Pollard would never escape Wolf's shadow, but he was not a jealous man. "I know George," he would laugh. "Big head, little ass, and roars like a lion." Pollard famously tried to take credit for giving Wolf the nickname Iceman, explaining it thus: "In all the smoking car stories I've ever heard, icemen and traveling salesmen were very immoral characters. George does not have a pleasing enough personality to be a traveling salesman." Wolf replied in the same vein. "You don't have to be an athlete to be a jockey," he told a reporter. "Why, Red Pollard is one of the smartest jockeys in the country today, and he doesn't have the strength to blow out a candle." In those early days, Pollard and Wolf found common ground in their quick minds, cerebral riding styles, and keen senses of humor. On the backstretch of Vancouver Racecourse in the summer of 1927, a friendship was forged in the crucible of the racetrack and adolescence. It would endure long into manhood and bind them together in history. Chapter 5. A Boot on One Foot, a Toe Tag on the Other. On a Saturday afternoon in July 1938, a half-starved teenager wandered into a bus station in Columbus, Ohio, appearing confused and disoriented. A policeman approached and tried to speak with him, but the boy seemed not to know his own name. In his pockets, the officer found $112, a bus ticket for Petersburg, Illinois, and documents that identified him as Thomas Dowell, an obscure local jockey. Seeing that Dowell was in profound distress, the officer took him to the police station, where a police surgeon sat with him and tried to find out what was wrong. Dowell remained mute, but appeared deeply shaken. Concerned that the boy might get hurt if released, the doctor sat him down in a holding cell and left to telephone his mother. While the officer was gone, Dowell slipped his belt off, coiled it around his neck, and hanged himself. When word of the suicide made its way to the backstretch, no one seemed surprised. In his brief career, Dowell had learned what Red Pollard, George Wolf, and countless other riders had long since known, a jockey's life was nothing short of appalling. No athletes suffered more for their sport. The jockey lived hard and lean, intended to die young, trampled under the hooves of horses or imploding from the pressures of his vocation. For 3 years, Dowell had known the singular strain of the jockey's job, torturing his body to keep it at an inhumanly low weight, groveling for mounts in the mornings, and enduring punishing violence in the afternoons, waiting in vain for the big horse that would bear him from poverty and peril. Dowell was no anomaly, and everyone in the backstretch knew it. His was a life no different from that of almost every other jockey. Under its terrific weight, Dowell had come undone. They called the scale the Oracle, and they lived in slavery to it. In the 1920s and 1930s, the imposts, or weights horses were assigned to carry in races, generally ranged from 83 pounds to 130 or more, depending on the rank of the horse and the importance of the race. A rider could be no more than 5 pounds over the assigned weight, or he would be taken off the horse. Some trainers trimmed that leeway down to just a half pound. To make weight in anything but high-class stakes races, jockeys had to keep their weight to no more than 114 pounds. Riders competing in ordinary weekday events needed to whittle themselves down another 5 pounds or so, while those in the lowest echelons of the sport couldn't weigh much more than 100. The lighter a rider was, the greater the number of horses he could ride. Some riders, wrote Eddie Arcaro, will all but saw their legs off to get within the limit. A few riders were naturally tiny enough to make weight without difficulty, and they earned the burning envy of every other jockey. Most of them were young teenagers whose growth spurts lay ahead of them. To ensure that they didn't waste time and money training and supporting boys who would eventually grow out of their trade, contract trainers checked the foot size of every potential bug boy, since a large foot is a fairly good sign of a coming growth spurt. Many also inspected the height and weight of a potential bug boy's siblings. Trainer Woody Stevens, who began his racing career as a bug boy in the late 1920s, always felt he got lucky in this respect. In vetting him for the job, his trainer neglected to look at his sister, a local basketball phenom. Virtually every adult rider and most of the kids naturally tended to weigh too much. Cheating, if you did it right, could help a little. One pudgy 140-pound rider earned a place in reinsman legend by fooling a profoundly myopic clerk of scales by skewing the readout to register him at 110. No one is exactly sure how he did it, but it is believed that either he positioned his feet on a non-registering part of the scale or his valet stuck his whip under his seat and lifted up. He made it through an entire season before someone caught him. Most jockeys took a more straightforward approach, the radical diet, consisting of 600 calories a day. Red Pollard went as long as a year eating nothing but eggs. Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons confessed that during his riding days, a typical dinner consisted of a leaf or two of lettuce, and he would eat them only after placing them on a windowsill to dry the water out of them. Water, because of its weight, was the prime enemy, and jockeys went to absurd lengths to keep it out of their systems. Most drank virtually nothing. A common practice was to have jockeys' room valets open soda cans by puncturing the top with an ice pick, making it impossible to drink more than a few drops at a time. The sight and sound of water became a torment. Fitzsimmons habitually avoided areas of the barn where horses were being washed because the spectacle of flowing water was agonizing. But the weight maximums were so low that near fasting and water deprivation weren't enough. Even what little water and calories the body had taken in had to be eliminated. Many riders were heavers, poking their fingers down their throats to vomit up their meals. Others chewed gum to trigger salivation. Tommy Luther could spit off as much as half a pound in a few hours. Then there were the sweating rituals, topped by road work. This practice, used by both Red Pollard and George Wolfe, involved donning heavy underwear, zipping into a rubber suit, swaddling in hooded winter gear and woolen horse blankets, then running around and around the track, preferably under a blistering summer sun. Stevens remembered seeing jockeys in full road work attire gathering at a bowling alley, so lathered that sweat spouted from their shoes with each step. After road work, there were Turkish baths, where jockeys congregated for mornings of communal sweating. The desiccation practices of jockeys were lampooned by turf rider Joe H. Palmer in a column written on jockey Abelardo de Lara. De Lara has to sweat off about 2 pounds a day to make weight. Last year, by his own estimate, he lost about 600 pounds this way. Since he weighs about 110, it is a mere matter of arithmetic that he would be a bit more than 700 pounds if he hadn't reduced so regularly. Most jockeys ingested every manner of laxative to purge their systems of food and water. Diarrhea became the constant companion of many riders, some of whom became virtuosos of defecation. Helen Luther once watched a rider step on a scale, only to see that he was over his horse's assigned impost. He shouted to the clerk of scales to hang on, raced to the bathroom, emerged a moment later with his pants still at half-mast, and made weight. Such results could be had from a variety of products, including a stomach-turning mix of Epsom salts and water, chased by two fingers of rye to stop the gagging reflex, a plant-derived purgative called jollop, or bottles of a wretched-tasting formula known as Pluto water. But the undisputed champ of the purgatives was born in the enterprising mind of a jockey's masseur named Frank Frenchie Hawley. Prowling around the Tijuana jockey's room in reassuringly medical-looking Dr. Kildare attire, Frenchie was the self-appointed mad scientist of the racing world. Operating out of a gleaming white training room, Frenchie stocked every manner of weight loss facilitator, including electric blankets, infrared lamps, electric light cabinets, baking machines, violet rays, vibrating contraptions, and rubber sleeping bags and sheets. He also dreamed up a particularly foul-smelling recipe for self-parboiling that required riders to steep for up to 35 minutes, fewer if they became dizzy, in piping hot water mixed with 3 to 5 pounds of Epsom salts, 1 quart of white vinegar, 2 ounces of household ammonia, and a mystery lather he called Hawley's Cream. He kept careful records of the weight he had stripped from riders. By 1945, it totaled 12,860 pounds, more than 6 tons. One of Frenchie's cardinal rules of reducing was to keep the contents of the bowels moving down and out steadily and regularly. To devise a mix that would bring this about, he tinkered around with God knows what until he stumbled upon a home brew that delivered a ferocious kick. The caustic laxative worked so well that Hawley marketed it commercially under the disarmingly innocuous name Slim Jim. Former jockey Bill Buck remembered it with a shiver. "It'd kill you." He wasn't kidding. Frenchie's bowel scour proved to be so fabulously potent that bottles of it spontaneously exploded in the jockey's room lavatory. Imagining their intestines going out in a similar blaze of glory, even the jockeys began to fear it, and Hawley's Slim Jim experiment went down the tubes. For jockeys who were truly desperate, there was one last resort. Contact the right people, and you could get hold of a special capsule, a simple pill guaranteed to take off all the weight you wanted. In it was the egg of a tapeworm. Within a short while, the parasite would attach to a man's intestines and slowly suck the nutrients out of him. The pounds would peel away like magic. When the host jockey became too malnourished, he could check into a hospital to have the worm removed, then return to the track and swallow a new pill. Red Pollard may have resorted to this solution. In denying their bodies the most basic necessities, jockeys demonstrated incredible fortitude. They paid a fearsome price. Most walked around in a state of critical dehydration and malnutrition, and as a result were irritable, volatile, lightheaded, bleary, nauseated, gaunt, and crampy. The heavers, exposing their mouths to repeated onslaughts of stomach acid, lost the enamel on their teeth, and eventually the teeth themselves. Other jockeys suffered bouts of weakness so severe that when boosted into the saddle, they would fall right off the other side. Dehydration left them so prone to overheating, even in mild weather, that their valets prepared huge bins of ice cubes into which they could flop to cool off. Other riders suffered fainting spells or hallucinated. Many jockeys' bodies could not function under the strain. To take off enough weight to ride a horse in Windsor, Canada, Sonny Greenberg steamed in a Turkish bath, guzzled Epsom salts mixed with jalap, took a boat from Detroit to Windsor, vomiting all the way, donned a rubber suit over several layers of heavy clothing, and ran around and around the track. He staggered into the woods, collapsed, and either fell asleep or fainted. He awoke in a pool of sweat and tried to clear his disorientation by downing a half ounce of whiskey. Dragging himself to a scale, he found that he had suffered away 10.5 pounds in one night. It was all for naught. By post time, he was too weak even to sit upright in a saddle. He gave someone else the mount and retired soon afterward. Greenberg escaped without permanent damage, but others, including Fitzsimmons, may not have been so lucky. Severe reducing was thought to be the culprit behind an epidemic of fatal lung diseases, such as pneumonia and tuberculosis among jockeys. Other long-term health problems may also have stemmed from reducing practices. In a single day, to make weight on a horse, Fitzsimmons endured purgatives an entire afternoon in a Turkish bath, heavy exercise on horseback and on foot, while swaddled in several sweaters and a muffler, topped off with an hour standing inches from a roaring brick kiln. He lost 13 pounds. Thick-tongued and groggy, he won the race by a nose, but couldn't repeat the weight-loss performance and retired from the saddle not much later. He soon experienced the first shooting pains from the severe arthritis that would grotesquely disfigure his body. He came to believe that that one terrible day of reducing may have triggered the onset of the crippling disease. Finally, there was the mental toll. Stevens described his realization that he could no longer take the punishment of reducing as the biggest disappointment of my life. The legendary 19th-century European jockey Fred Archer understood the emotion. Falling into a severe depression, attributed to his taking constant doses of purgatives to fight a weight problem he could not beat, he shot himself to death at age 29. A thoroughbred racehorse is one of God's most impressive engines. Tipping the scales at up to 1,450 pounds, he can sustain speeds of 40 miles per hour. Equipped with reflexes much faster than those of the most quick-wired man, he swoops over as much as 28 feet of earth in a single stride and corners on a dime. His body is a paradox of mass and lightness, crafted to slip through air with the ease of an arrow. His mind is impressed with a single command, run. He pursues speed with superlative courage, pushing beyond defeat, beyond exhaustion, sometimes beyond the structural limits of bone and sinew. In flight, he is nature's ultimate wedding of form and purpose. To pilot a racehorse is to ride a half-ton catapult. It is without question one of the most formidable feats in sport. The extraordinary athleticism of the jockey is unparalleled. A study of the elements of athleticism conducted by Los Angeles exercise physiologists and physicians found that of all major sports competitors, jockeys may be, pound for pound, the best overall athletes. They have to be. To begin with, there are the demands on balance, coordination, and reflex. A horse's body is a constantly shifting topography, with a bobbing head and neck, and roiling muscle over the shoulders, back, and rump. On a running horse, a jockey does not sit in the saddle, he crouches over it, leaning all of his weight on his toes, which rest on the thin metal bases of stirrups, dangling about a foot from the horse's top line. When a horse is in full stride, the only parts of the jockey that are in continuous contact with the animal are the insides of the feet and ankles. Everything else is balanced in midair. In other words, jockeys squat on the pitching backs of their mounts, a task much like perching on the grill of a car while it speeds down a twisting, potholed freeway in traffic. The stance is, in the words of University of North Carolina researchers, a situation of dynamic imbalance and ballistic opportunity. The center of balance is so narrow that if jockeys shift only slightly rearward, they will flip right off the back. If they tip more than a few inches forward, a fall is almost inevitable. A thoroughbred's neck, while broad from top to bottom, is surprisingly narrow in width.